So, picture a perfectly curated couple. You know the type, right?
No, we all know the type.
Right. You look at the grid online, and it is just this relentless stream of holiday cheer, flawlessly dressed kids, maybe some subtle brags about a massive new promotion at work.
Just completely invincible.
Yeah, they look invincible, but now picture the reality behind the camera. Like, they are drowning in secret debt, the promotion is hanging by a thread, and their entire marriage is basically an exhausting, meticulously choreographed performance just to keep the grid alive.
It's exhausting just thinking about
It
it.
really is. And the thing is, that is not some snapshot of modern anxiety. I mean, it is, but it's actually the exact premise of Henrik Ibsen's 1879 masterpiece, A Doll's House.
Which is wild to think about.
It's wild. We're not walking through some dusty museum exhibit of top hats and polite parlor rooms today. For this deep dive, we are breaking down what is essentially a high-stakes, sweat-inducing domestic thriller. And it ends with a literal bang.
Well, a
A
slam.
slam, yes, the famous door slam.
Right, because it operates entirely like a ticking time bomb. Ibsen disguises it as this quiet living room drama, but the tension is just relentless.
It really is.
And to really unpack why that tension holds up for us today, we need to kind of strip away our 21st century assumptions about marriage. We have to look at the trap these characters are actually in.
Because it's a very specific trap.
Very specific. The entire narrative hinges on a cultural reality that feels alien to us now, but it was a matter of absolute survival in 1879, and that is respectability. Respectability as the ultimate currency.
Okay, I want to push on that idea of respectability, though, because looking at the text, the husband, Torvald Helmer, he has just landed this life-altering position as a bank manager.
Right, it's a huge deal for them.
It's a huge deal. They are finally transitioning out of years of grinding financial struggle into what they literally call a big salary.
Yeah, the promised land.
Right. So you'd think that would bring some relief, you know? You'd think they could exhale.
You would think so.
But instead, Torvald seems to double down. He has this obsession with the aesthetics of morality. He acts like the slightest misstep is going to destroy them.
Because in his mind, it will.
But isn't this obsession with moral corruption and maintaining a pristine home actually just a massive projection? Like a projection of his own intense fragility?
What do you mean?
Well, he plays the towering pillar of patriarchal strength, but honestly, he reads as terrified to me.
Okay, I hear that. But calling him fragile might be letting him off the hook a bit too easily. Or at least, it's misidentifying the source of his fear.
Okay, tell me more.
It is not just internal fragility, right? It is structural reality. In this society, a wife is legally barred from borrowing money without her husband's explicit consent.
Which is just crazy to think about today.
Completely crazy. She is, in the eyes of the law and the economy, essentially a minor. So Torvald is not just protecting his ego, he is protecting their literal ability to eat and function in society.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the bank manager position is brand new. The ink is barely dry on his contract. So his obsession with avoiding debt isn't just about looking good. Debt, in his view, destroys the freedom and beauty of a home.
Because it puts you at the mercy of other people.
Yes,
Yes.
exactly. I mean, it puts you at the mercy of other people's judgment.
But the language he uses goes so far beyond practical financial
And he's
advice.
incredibly dramatic.
Right. He gives these sweeping, terrifying speeches claiming that a deceitful mother infects the very air her children breathe with germs of evil.
Germs of evil, yeah.
That isn't accounting. That is a man who conflates financial propriety with spiritual purity. He cannot bend. He requires absolute perfection.
It does.
And because he is so rigid, his wife, Nora, she basically has to bend reality around him just to keep him functioning.
Which sets the stage for the massive lie at the center of their marriage.
Yes, let's get into the lie.
Let's map out the architecture of this secret. Assuming you, listening, might have heard of the door slam, but maybe missed the intricate mechanics of how we actually get there. Yeah, let's break it down.
So on the surface, Nora plays the role of the frivolous spendthrift. Torvald calls her his little skylark and his little squirrel.
Ugh, the pet names.
They are so grating, and he's constantly chiding her for wasting money. But years prior, Torvald was deathly ill.
Like knocking on death's door.
Right. His doctors told Nora he needed to go south to Italy to survive, but they were entirely broke.
And because of those coverture laws we just mentioned, she couldn't simply walk into a bank and take out a medical loan.
She had zero legal standing.
None. So she goes to a man named Nils Krogstad. He's this guy operating very much in the moral gray areas of their town.
He's sort of a loan shark figure.
Yeah, shady guy.
Yeah.
And she borrows £250. But to get the money, she forges her dying father's signature on the bond.
Which is a serious crime.
A huge crime. And for years, she has been secretly skimming money off her household allowance, taking on grueling late-night copying work just to make the payments to Krogstad.
All while smiling and telling Torvald the money was an inheritance. Right. The dramatic irony here is just suffocating. Torvald believes he is the sole provider, the ultimate protector of the house.
When in reality, his life was saved by his wife's criminal ingenuity.
Yes. And his comfortable home is financed by her secret, exhausting labor.
It's wild. And then Ibsen introduces the inciting incident that forces this whole secret into the light.
Yeah, right. Because secrets in a play like this never stay buried.
Never. So Torvald, flexing his new power as the bank manager, plans to fire Krogstad.
Ah, the loan shark.
Right. Because Krogstad's shady past threatens the pristine image Torvald wants for the bank.
It's all about the image.
Always. And to make matters worse, Torvald plans to give Krogstad's job to Mrs. Christine Lind. She's Nora's old childhood friend who has just arrived in town desperate for work.
The geometry of that conflict is just brilliant.
It really is.
You have a tight quadrant of people whose needs are totally mutually exclusive.
Right. Someone has to lose.
Exactly. So Krogstad realizes he is being ousted, and he goes to Nora and delivers a very clear ultimatum.
A terrifying ultimatum.
He tells her to use her influence over her husband to save his job, or he will expose the forgery. He will burn her life to the ground.
And he doesn't just make a verbal threat.
No, he doesn't.
Because when Nora inevitably fails to sway Torvald, because Torvald's pride will not allow him to take professional advice from his wife, Krogstad takes action.
He goes nuclear.
He writes a letter detailing the entire fraudulent transaction, the forgery, the secret debt, and he drops it into the Helmer's locked letterbox in the hallway.
Oh, man, the letterbox.
It's such a great prop.
That single prop does so much heavy lifting because Torvald is the only one who has the key to that box.
Right. The patriarch holds the key.
Literally. And Nora can see the letter sitting there through the glass front, but she cannot reach it.
She's just trapped looking at her own doom.
Yeah. Think about the modern anxiety of seeing a catastrophic text message sitting on a locked phone screen.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Like, you know someone sent a message that is going to detonate your entire life. You see the notification hovering there, but you don't have the passcode.
You can't delete it?
You can't do anything. You just have to sit there and wait for the owner of the phone to pick it up and read it.
That is agonizing.
Nora is living that exact agony, pacing back and forth in her own hallway, just dancing around an active bomb.
And the presence of that letter is what forces the climax. We really need to look closely at what happens when Torvald finally opens the box.
Because it changes everything.
It shatters Nora's entire worldview.
Hmm.
See, Nora operates under the assumption that when the truth is revealed, a wonderful thing will happen.
The wonderful thing. She talks about it so much.
She is utterly convinced that Torvald will step forward, take the blame, and sacrifice his own reputation to shield hers.
Right. She believes she is living in a romantic melodrama, and he is the knight in shining armor.
Yeah. She bought the fairy tales. She was sold. Society told her men are noble protectors, so she expects a noble protector.
But when Torvald reads the letter, the reality is brutally different.
So different.
He turns on her with terrifying speed. He calls her a hypocrite, a liar, a criminal.
He completely loses it.
He tells her she has no religion, no morals, and he forbids her from raising their children.
There is zero heroism.
None. He throws her to the wolves to save his own skin without a second of hesitation.
And then Ibsen executes this breathtaking reversal.
It gives you whiplash.
Moments after Torvald's tirade, a second letter arrives. Through a series of events involving Mrs. Lind, Krogstad actually has a change of heart.
Right, he backs down.
He returns the forged bond. The threat of public ruin is instantly erased.
Just like that.
And watch Torvald's reaction. In the span of a single breath, he burns the bond, shouts, "I am saved," and attempts to reset the marriage.
He goes right back to calling her his frightened little singing bird, as if he hadn't just destroyed her world. And the thing is, "I am saved." That is the most telling pronoun in the entire play.
Not, "We are saved."
Right. "I am saved." That is the exact second the illusion breaks for Nora.
She sees him clearly for the first time.
She realizes she has been living with a complete stranger for 8 years. She has been a doll performing in a dollhouse for a man who loves the performance, not the person.
Yeah, the illusion is just shattered.
So she sits down, delivers this devastating indictment of their entire life together, and she walks out.
And that trajectory from playing the doll to walking out the door, it actually brings up a really common trap for audiences today.
Oh, definitely.
Because Nora is so compliant in the beginning, it is very easy to misread her as a passive, naive victim of her circumstances.
People judge her really harshly.
I do. They hear the humming, the macaroon eating, the begging for money, and they dismiss her as irritating or helpless.
I mean, I admit, the first time you encounter the baby talk, it is grating.
It's hard to listen to.
Torvald asks, "Is that my little lark twittering out there?" And she chirps back, "Yes, it is. You really just want to shake her."
Yeah, it feels so demeaning.
But if you look past the surface performance, you realize she is intensely aware of the system she is trapped in.
She really is.
She is playing the only hand available to her. Like, she tells Mrs. Lind about the late night copying work, locking herself in a room, and she admits, "It was a tremendous pleasure to sit there working and earning money. It was like being a man."
That line unlocks her entire character.
It totally does.
It was like being a man. She equates financial agency with masculinity because her society enforces that division.
Right. She knows power is gendered.
So she constructs a backdoor to power. She weaponizes Torvald's condescension.
It's brilliant.
When she needs cash to pay down her secret life-saving debt, she doesn't sit him down and ask for a budget increase like an equal partner.
Because he would never go for that.
Never. Instead, she plays with his coat buttons, she averts her eyes, she plays the sweet little spendthrift.
It is weaponized incompetence used defensively.
Yes, exactly.
She manages her husband because she isn't legally allowed to manage a bank loan.
She feeds his superiority complex.
Ensuring he feels big and powerful, specifically to extract the resources she needs to keep their family afloat. It is a brilliant, desperate survival strategy.
And Ibsen leaves breadcrumbs of this deceptive capability everywhere, starting with the very first scene.
Oh, the macaroons.
The macaroons. The motif of the macaroons is critical here. It seems like a trivial domestic detail, but it establishes the entire dynamic of their marriage before the plot even kicks in.
Yeah, let's talk about the macaroons. Torvald has explicitly forbidden her from eating them.
Right. He claims they will ruin her teeth.
Again, it comes back to aesthetics. He demands a physically flawless wife.
Always the aesthetics.
But before Torvald even walks on stage, we watch Nora pull a bag of macaroons from her pocket, eat several, and wipe her mouth.
She's hiding the evidence.
Yes. And when he comes out and interrogates her, asking if Miss Sweet Tooth has been breaking the rules, she lies straight to his face without a flinch.
She says, "No, Torvald, I assure you, really."
And she's so convincing.
The ease of that lie is the point. He treats her like a toddler who cannot be trusted with sugar.
So she responds by playing the part of the sneaky toddler.
But beneath that trivial lie about cookies lies the capacity to sustain a massive multi-year financial conspiracy.
It's a proof of concept.
Right. The macaroons prove she can maintain dual realities. She can look her husband in the eye, perform obedience, and conceal her defiance simultaneously.
And this tension between the outward performance and her inward terror, it builds relentlessly. And it physically manifests in Act Two during the Tarantella scene.
Arguably the most famous sequence in the text.
Oh, for sure. So Torvald decides Nora will attend a fancy dress ball as a Neapolitan fisher girl and perform the Tarantella.
Which is a vibrant, exhausting Italian folk dance.
Right. But the context surrounding the dance transforms it from a parlor trick into a matter of life and death.
Because the letter is already in the box.
The letter from Krogstad is sitting right there in the locked box. Nora knows Torvald is going to open it the moment the evening concludes.
She's completely out of time.
So, to prevent him from going near the hallway, she begs him to help her practice the dance.
And she dances violently.
The stage directions are so specific. Her hair comes down, falling over her shoulders, but she doesn't stop to fix it.
She ignores his instructions to slow down.
Torvald watches her and says, "My dear, darling Nora, you are dancing as if your life depended on it."
And her response is chillingly literal.
So it does.
So it does.
Oh, it gives me chills.
Because historically, the tarantella was believed to be a cure for the bite of a tarantula.
Right. You have to sweat it out.
The victim would dance frantically to sweat the venom out of their system. Nora's dancing to sweat out the poison of her own secrets.
It is an exertion born of absolute panic.
It really is.
Think of it as a full-blown panic attack set to sheet music. For 8 years, she has carefully executed the slow, deliberate, choreographed routine of the perfect wife.
But the presence of that letter breaks the choreography.
The doll glitches. She moves with this raw, desperate, uncontainable fear. It is a brilliant physicalization of her mental state.
And the tarantella also forces us to confront Nora's delusion about the wonderful thing that she believes will happen when the Jans ends and the truth is known.
Right, the fantasy.
We discussed her romantic expectations, but Ibsen actively contrasts her fantasy with cold reality through the character of Dr. Rank.
Yeah, Dr. Rank is such an interesting figure in all of this.
He is Torvald's closest friend, but he is dying of a spinal disease.
He is physically decaying, which he attributes to his father's youthful excesses.
The sins of the father being visited upon the child, a very common theme in this era.
But what is truly revealing is how Dr. Rank handles his impending death, and more importantly, how Torvald reacts to it.
Yes. Rank tells Nora that when the end is near, he will send a calling card marked with a black cross.
And he explicitly states that he will lock his door to Torvald.
Why? Because, as Rank puts it, Torvald has an unconquerable disgust at everything that is ugly.
Wow.
Torvald cannot stomach the messy, painful physical reality of death. He demands a beautiful world.
And Nora completely misses this massive red flag.
She doesn't see it at all.
She is banking her entire future on the idea that Torvald will show immense moral courage and ruin his own life to save hers.
But if Torvald is too aesthetically cowardly to simply sit in a room with his dying best friend,
how on earth is he going to face a public scandal?
He can't. He only wants the beautiful apparition.
Even after the party, when he is making advances toward Nora, he talks about pretending she is his secret bride arriving for the first time.
He is constantly role-playing.
He doesn't want the complex, stressed, indebted woman standing in front of him. He wants a painting.
And when the ugly reality of the forged bond shatters that painting, Torvald's aesthetic universe collapses.
His cowardice is the inevitable result of his worldview.
Now, analyzing this text on a page allows us to see these themes, but we are looking at this through the lens of the Clara Noratio audiobook production.
Right, which changes things entirely.
And the transition from page to audio fundamentally alters the psychological weight of the story.
Well, theater is inherently auditory, but an audiobook traps you in a way a stage production does not.
How do you mean?
Ibsen designed the play to take place entirely within a single room, the Helmer's living room.
Right. One set.
When you watch it on stage, your eyes can wander to the architecture of the theater, the reactions of the audience.
You have some distance.
Exactly. But when you listen to it via headphones, you are locked inside that domestic cage with Nora. You cannot look away.
The auditory format magnifies the claustrophobia.
Big time.
The sound design elements Ibsen wrote into the script become so visceral.
Like the children's voices.
Yes, you hear the joyful, overlapping voices of the children abruptly severed by Krogstad's heavy, terrifying knock at the door.
That knock makes me jump every time.
And you hear the relentless physical pacing.
Yeah.
And crucially, you hear the specific metallic sound of the letter dropping into the locked box.
Yes. The sound of that letter dropping is engineered to sound like the click of a gun being cocked.
That's a terrifying comparison.
But it's true. And beyond the Foley effects, the vocal performances expose the emotional violence of the text in ways reading simply cannot.
Oh, absolutely.
Like reading the pet names Featherhead, Little Miss Obstinate, it feels annoying.
Sure.
But hearing an actor deliver those lines directly into your ear, utilizing specific cadences of condescension, the paternalistic sighs, the pat on the head superiority.
It is physically suffocating.
It really is.
The audiobook also highlights the terrifying velocity of Torvald's shift in Act 3.
Oh, that whiplash we talked about.
When you hear a voice actor transition from screaming, "Miserable creature, what have you done?" to a soft cooing, "My frightened little singing bird," in a matter of seconds.
It's disturbing.
The emotional whiplash is disturbing. You recognize on a visceral level that Torvald lacks a stable emotional core.
His reactions are purely defensive reflexes to protect his status.
It makes his shallowness undeniable. And that brings us to what the play is actually saying to us today.
Right, the modern resonance.
Because if we reduce A Doll's House to a simple historical lecture about 19th century patriarchy, we strip it of its teeth.
We really do. The deeper psychological complexity is entirely relevant right now. The play is a brutal dissection of performative relationships.
Torvald is in love with the idea of Nora, the optic of a beautiful, compliant wife.
And frankly, Nora is in love with the fictional idea of Torvald as a stoic, self-sacrificing hero.
Yes, neither of them are seeing each other.
When the crisis forces them to drop the scripts they have been reading from, they stare at each other and realize they're strangers who've been playing house.
Look at Torvald's genuine reason for firing Krogstad.
Oh, this part is wild.
He admits to Nora that it isn't just about Krogstad's moral failings.
Oh, yeah.
It is because they knew each other as boys, and Krogstad has the audacity to use Torvald's first name at the bank.
Imagine firing someone over that.
He says Krogstad is tactless and says things like, "I say, Helmer, old fellow." Torvald is willing to destroy a man's livelihood, to plunge a family into poverty, simply to prevent a slight social embarrassment at the office.
His male ego is so fragile it cannot withstand a casual greeting.
Yet, we have to recognize that Torvald is also trapped by the script.
Yeah, he's a victim of it too, in a way.
He is awful, yes, but he is playing the role of the infallible provider and moral guardian because society demands it of him.
If he assumes the blame for the forgery, he loses his position, his respectability, and his identity as a man.
The social structure dictates that marriage is a transactional performance. Both of them are acting out the roles assigned to them until the stage catches fire.
And when Nora finally says, "Our home has been nothing but a playroom," she is indicting that entire system.
She's tearing it down.
She realizes she has to step completely outside of it to figure out who she actually is. She says, "I must stand quite alone if I am to understand myself and everything about me."
And to fully graph the tragedy of the Helmer's failure, Ibsen provides a profound contrast in the final act.
I'm so glad we're talking about this part.
We have to look at the resolution between the two supposed antagonists of the play, Mills Krogstad and Mrs. Lind.
Right. While the Helmers are upstairs at the party dancing, the Tarantella, Krogstad and Mrs. Lind have a quiet, desperate meeting in the living room.
We find out they were deeply in love years ago.
But she broke his heart to marry a wealthier man because she had a bedridden mother and two young brothers to support.
She made a brutal, pragmatic choice to survive.
But observe how they communicate now. There are no pet names. There is no baby talk.
There are no macaroons or elaborate costumes.
Exactly. Mrs. Lind looks at him and proposes a partnership. She says, "Nils, how would it be if we two shipwrecked people could join forces?"
It's such a raw moment.
She does not ask him to be her savior. She suggests that two people clinging to the same piece of wreckage have a better chance of surviving the storm than they do alone.
The phrase, "two shipwrecked people," is so stark, so devoid of romance, and yet it is the most genuinely romantic moment in the story.
I completely agree. They look at each other, acknowledge their damage, acknowledge their desperate circumstances, and choose to build a life on brutal, unvarnished honesty.
They drop the masks.
They are the anti-Helmers.
Ibsen demonstrates that a genuine partnership is achievable, but it requires the courage to strip away societal expectations and face the ugly reality together.
And Torvald lacked that courage entirely.
They really did.
The contrast is so sharp, it cuts. And honestly, if you want to experience the slow burn tension, the quiet, desperate manipulations, and the claustrophobic terror of that locked letterbox, I highly recommend finding the full Clara Naraschi audiobook of A Doll's House.
Yeah, it's an incredible production.
Pay attention to the breathing. Pay attention to the exact tone Torvald uses when he calls her his Skylark.
The vocal performances will change your understanding of the text.
And as you think about that final famous moment, the door slamming shut behind Nora as she leaves the playroom for good, consider this. Everyone focuses on the triumph of the exit, but think about the profound, terrifying silence of the next morning. She walks out into an 1879 winter with no credit, no references, no legal standing, and no home.
It's not a happy ending. It's a terrifying beginning.
Exactly. The real power of the play isn't just that she leaves the dollhouse. It is the staggering, dangerous unknown she is willing to face, rather than live one more day inside a perfectly curated lie.
That's a really haunting way to think about it.
Something to keep in mind the next time you find yourself scrolling through a flawless grid online.